The title of this talk is The Quote Holy Unquote Stones Found Near Newark, Ohio in the 1860s. Now, a little bit of background here. Okay. The Bible tells us that Tiglath-Pileser, or Shalmaneser, after the defeat of Israel, transported the majority of the inhabitants of the northern kingdom to Assyria and placed them 730 BCE. Okay. And he moved them to different places. Okay. And there has been much mystery as to what happened to these 10 lost tribes. Where are they? There are many groups that claim, that have claimed over the years, that they're descended from these tribes. They include what are called the B'nai Ephraim in southern India, who claim that they're descended from the tribe of Ephraim, the Nazranis in Kerala, India, the B'nai Israel from the Indian cities of Mumbai, Pune, Ahmedabad, and the Pakistani states of Karachi, Peshawar, and Multan, the B'nai Menashe of northeast India, who claim to be descended from the tribe of Menashe, and various other groups that claim to be descended from the 10 tribes. Now, there's great interest in the 10 tribes because, according to biblical prophecy, when the Messiah comes, the 10 tribes will again be gathered in as part of the Messianic Age. So, people were interested. Where are they? Now, perhaps the most bizarre claim regarding the lost tribes was the belief, and it was held during the 17th, 18th, and 9th, and even into the 19th century, that the Native Americans found here when Columbus and others came were descended from the 10 lost tribes. And as strange as this may sound to us, this was taken very, very seriously by, first of all, certain Episcopal groups, the Mormons. It's a fundamental tenet of their faith. I don't know whether it still is, but that the 10 tribes are descended from that the Indians are descended from the lost 10 tribes. And in fact, there's a book, I give a gentleman by the name of James Adair, who spent in the 18th century time with the Indians, and he gives 23 arguments as to why the Indians are descended from the 10 lost tribes. He claims that in their language there are certain words that are Hebrew words. He claims that certain of their burial practices and various other things. So this was actually a belief, and it went into, even in the 1830s, a gentleman by the name of Mordechai Emanuel Noah gave a speech that was well accepted in New York, and he was a leader of the New York Jewish community, saying that the Indians are descended from the 10 lost tribes. So that's sort of a background, okay? That's running around here in the background, and now we'll get to the quote-unquote holy stones. Now, there's something called mound builders, and that's the name that was given to the Native American peoples who built mounds in an area that stretched from the Great Lakes to the Gulf of Mexico and from the Mississippi River to the Appalachian Mountains. Those who constructed these mounds were referred to as mound builders, since at one time the origin of these mounds was shrouded in mystery. In fact, it wasn't until the late 19th century that most Americans of European extraction were willing to grant that the American Indians had built them. They felt that the American Indians didn't have the technology, they didn't have the knowledge, they were such primitive people, they could never have built them.
Some of the mounds, well, they were excavated, they covered something.
Well, some of these mounds were built nearly 1,000 years before the Egyptian pyramids. The last mounds were built in the 16th century, many were burial mounds, but others were temple mounds serving as platforms for religious structures. Hernando de Soto, a Spanish conquistador who from 1540 to 1542 traversed most of what became the southeast United States, reported encountering many different mound builder peoples. Given the nature of these mounds, digging in them often leads to unearthing objects that give insight into the lives of the people who constructed them. However, you wouldn't expect that if you dug in one of these mounds that you would find any objects that are associated with Jews. But that's exactly what happened at a burial mound located in Newark, Ohio. At least that's what claimed would happen. Now, we're going to talk about a gentleman by the name of David Wyrick. Wyrick, W-Y-R-I-C-K. David Wyrick, W-Y-R-I-C-K. He lived from 1806 to 1864. He was a printer, and eventually he moved to near to Newark, Ohio, and he became the county surveyor in 1850. He suffered from severe rheumatoid arthritis, took a drug called laudanum, I'm not sure what that is, to be honest with you. Okay, for his condition, he was described by his good friend, supporter, and prominent local figure, Charles Widdersley, in this way. He was physically disabled by rheumatism, by which he suffered intensely. His fingers were swollen and distorted, and his feet so much enlarged as to render them almost useless, and that his appendages were so disfigured as scarcely to retain their human aspect. He was ever regarded with commiseration. He goes on to say that Wyrick was wholly a self-taught man, in many respects possessed of genius, and after continually battling this ailment, he retired as county surveyor in about 1859, and he spent time in these digging in these mounds. By the way, he killed himself, it seems. He died anyway of an overdose of this laudanum in 1864. In June 1860, David Wyrick of Newark, Ohio, a printer by trade who dabbled in ancient languages and was much interested in the remains of the mound builders, found about 1 mile southwest of Newark, Ohio, in one of the circular artificial depressions common among the ancient earthworks preserved in Licking County, a wedge-shaped stone not quite 6 inches long and measuring 3 inches in its widest part. It tapered at the small end, which in itself was a flattened surface about half an inch in diameter. A handle rested on the head of the wedge at the other end. On each of the four sides was a Hebrew inscription. That's the first picture, by the way, that I gave you right on top. Okay, there was a Hebrew inscription on each side. Okay, one said Melech Eretz, which means King of the Earth in Hebrew. One said Torah Hashem, the Law of the Lord. One said Dvar Hashem, the word of the Lord, and the other said Kodesh Kodashim, Holy of Holies. The letters were all very clear, but as students were not slow in discerning, they were not at all of an archaeological character, nor did the stone itself have the appearance of antiquity. Now, of antiquity. Mm-hmm. Let's back up here and understand something. There's more than one way to write Hebrew. And Hebrew was written commonly before the time of Ezra in one alphabet, and from the time of Ezra on, it was written in a different alphabet. And the alphabet that these stones are written in is after the time of Ezra. So it dates, at least in that sense, these stones. Okay. Now, because of the shape of the stone, it was called the keystone. Called the keystone. The following November, Wyrick made an even more striking quote-unquote find. He discovered what has come to be known as the Decalogue Stone, Ten Commandments Stone. Wyrick took a number of workmen and excavated in the Great Stone Mound located near Newark, Ohio. Presently, there was unearthed a stone casket 18 inches long and 12 inches wide. This casket, upon being opened, was found to contain a slab 6 7/8 inches long, 1 5/8 inches thick, and 2 7/8 inches wide. On one side of the stone was a carved human figure, and you can see that in the picture. If you look right in the middle, that's the second picture in the middle. Very fierce and pugnacious looking, according to this quote. In turban and priestly robes, this figure stood out in relief from the surface of the stone. Above the figure, the word Moshe, that's Moses in Hebrew. Moshe, the name of the great Jewish lawgiver, was inscribed. So evidently, this was intended to be a presentment of Moses. Above this name was an arcing circular border which ran down both sides of the image to its feet. At the bottom of the stone was a round handle attached to the stone at both ends, while in the middle was an empty space through which, as was suggested, a strap was intended to be passed, wherewith the stone was to be carried. Every available bit of space, with the exception of the handle, was carved with Hebrew characters, which were found to be a reproduction of the Ten Commandments, but not all of the Ten Commandments. They were not the full text of the Ten Commandments in Hebrew. The inscription is carved into a fine-grained black stone that only appears to be brown in the accompanying overexposed color photographs. That's what you're seeing here. It has been identified by geologists Ken Bork and Dave Hawkins of Denison University as limestone. A fossil crinoid stem is visible on the surface, and the stone reacts strongly to hydrogen chloride. One of the people accompanying Warwick, when he found the Decalogue stone, found a stone bowl. It was made of the same material as the box and has the capacity of a teacup. The bowl was long neglected, but was found recently in the storage rooms of the Johnson Humrick House Museum of Dr. Bradley Lepper of the Ohio Historical Society. So you have on the second page, okay, you have a description of how the text. It says the text begins at the top of the arch, over the head of the robed and bearded figure, identified in large letters as Moses, runs down the side of the front, winds around every available space in the back and sides, and then comes back up the right side of the front to finish exactly where it began without stretching or squeezing the letters. In itself, this represents a considerable feat of planning. And you have another picture of this stone on page 3. That's the back of the stone, okay? And then also on page 3, I have the exhibit as it is shown in this museum, okay? And I point out here that note that the Hebrew writing on both stones is in the square script alphabet of what's called Ksav Ashuri, as known as post-exilic or imperial Aramaic Hebrew, which was introduced in the time of Ezra, and not in Ksav Ivri's script, also known as pre-exilic or paleo-Hebrew, which was used by Jews in earlier times. This has implications regarding the dating of the stones, if they are indeed genuine. Now, there are more to this, though, okay? First of all, the discovery created an intense excitement far and near, and the holy stones of Newark, as they were called, aroused unusual attention in the archaeological and religious world. Dr. Nicole, the Episcopalian minister of Newark, declared them to be genuine. He was sure that they were authentic. In 1867, David M. Johnson, a banker who co-founded the Johnson Humrick House Museum, in conjunction with Dr. N. Roe Bradner, M.D. of Pennsylvania, found a fifth stone in the same mound group south of Newark in which Warwick had located the Decalogue. The original of this small stone is now lost, but a lithograph published in France survives. So, what are these things? What were these things? They're obviously curious. They're obviously strange, okay? Initially, many scholars believed that the Newark Holy Stones were authentic Jewish relics. Now, how they got here, that's a question, if they're authentic Jewish. That's a real question. However, as time passed, many archaeologists doubted their authenticity and declared them a hoax concocted by Warwick himself. However, there is evidence that seems to indicate that Warwick did not create these stones. Why? Because in 1861, Warwick published a pamphlet giving his account of the discoveries in which he included woodcuts he made that supposedly depicted, to the best of his ability, the inscriptions on the stones. A careful comparison of Warwick's woodcuts of the Decalogue to the actual inscription shows that out of 256 letters, Warwick made no less than 30 significant errors, in which he either made a legible letter illegible, turned a legible letter into a different letter, or omitted the letter altogether. Whoever carved the Decalogue stone had only imperfect knowledge of Hebrew and introduced a few errors of his own. Warwick, however, piled his own errors on top of these. He clearly did not even understand the inscription's peculiar, yet consistently applied alphabet, and therefore could not have been its author. Moses on the stone has a mild expression and fine features. He is wearing a turban and flowing robe, and is either holding a tablet or wearing a breastplate. Wyrix Moses, this is in his carvings, on the other hand, glares over a projecting nose. He is wearing a beret, not a turban. Mrs. Wyrick's 19th century dress is what he's wearing rather than a robe, and a minister's ecclesiastic shawl. Wyrick was evidently a fine draftsman, but not much at life drawing. Beverly H. Moseley, Jr., former art director of the Ohio Historical Society, has compared the carving of Moses on the stone to Wyrick's woodcut copy. It is his opinion as a professional artist that the same person could not have made these images. Archaeologist Stephen Williams claims that Wyrick was very committed to the lost tribes of Israel as the origin of the mound builders prior to the discovery of the keystone, with the implication that Wyrick may therefore have fabricated the keystone and decalogue in order to support his pet theory. In other words, that Wyrick was himself a follower of this idea that the Native Americans had descended from the 10 lost tribes. However, Wyrick somehow neglected to mention this alleged obsession in any of his surviving correspondence or even in his very pamphlet on the stones. He was described at the time of the Keystone discovery as merely an enthusiast for natural science. Wyrick's documented interests, besides mound exploration and surveying, included geomagnetism, anomalous boulders, river terraces, beaver dams, and sorghum processing, which I don't know what that is. In any event, the lost tribes of Israel would have used the pre-exilic old Hebrew alphabet, as I pointed out, rather than the post-exilic, that's after the time of Ezra, a square Hebrew alphabet adopted in the time of Ezra by the Jews, and which appears in two versions on both these stones. There is therefore no question of the lost tribes' connection here, Williams' misconception to the contrary notwithstanding. In other words, he's saying that Wyrick didn't make it, and it really has no connection to the 10 lost tribes. In 1999, archaeologist Bradley T. Lepper claimed that Reverend John W. McCarty and stonecutter Elijah Sutton made the keystone and decalogue stone and planted them where Wyrick would innocently find them. Lepper's view is based on the presumption that the stones must somehow be frauds, in conjunction with the entirely circumstantial evidence that A, McCarty knew how to read Hebrew and quickly translated the inscription despite its peculiar alphabet, B, Elijah Sutton was a stonecutter who carved Wyrick's tombstone along with many other Newark tombstones of the period, and C, the decalogue stone and the keystone are of approximately the same thickness as a typical Newark tombstone of the period. It's kind of far-fetched. Although McCarty did publish an article in a Cincinnati newspaper with a translation of the Decalogue stone within just a couple of days of its discovery, this feat would be no more difficult for a well-trained 19th century minister than it would be for any student of American history to decipher a copy of the Gettysburg Address that had been semi-encrypted by consistently replacing half the letters of the alphabet with distorted versions of themselves or even entirely arbitrary symbols. Once a few unencrypted words are recognized, the other letters fall into place quickly. A few days later, McCarty published a second article correcting some errors he had made in his initial interpretation. In his first attempt, for example, he read the letters over the head of the carved figure as Mem Shin Chest, or Mashiach, Messiah. In English, and concluded as a good Episcopalian minister that the figure was intended to represent Jesus Christ. In his second version, he read these letters correctly, Mem Shin Hei, which is Hebrew for Moshe, for Moses, and conceded that the figure, in fact, represented Moses. If he had composed the text himself, he would surely have gotten the translation right on the first try, particularly on such an important and, in retrospect, obvious point. It seems rather hasty to convict McCarty of composing the two Wyrick stones simply on the grounds that he happened to be the first Hebrew scholar to come along. This is particularly true given that there is not yet so much as a corpus delicti to indicate that a fraud had occurred in the first place. So what are they? Where are they? Where do they come from? It's a mystery. Well, one person who's around today claims that the Newark Holy Stones are indeed genuine, are real. Dr. Rachel Altman, a specialist in ancient phonetic-based writing systems, maintains that the Newark Holy Stones are indeed genuine. In her discussion of this topic, she notes that Dr. Arnold Fischel, lecturer at the Sephardic Synagogue in Newark, he was also the cantor there, a noted scholar and author, had written a paper, The Hebrew Inscribed Stones Found in Ohio, delivered in June of 1861 to the American Ethnological Society. In this paper, he stated he was convinced of the authenticity of the artifact and described it to medieval and European origins.
It
was used before the time of Ezra. Ezra is, I should have known this exactly. I'm going to give you a date that's not good.
But it would be before the Common Era.
Oh, yes. Okay. Yes. Ezra was the beginnings of the rebuilding of the Second Temple. And I should know that date like that, but I don't. Okay, I don't. And the Second Temple was destroyed in the first century. And it stood for several hundred years.
For them to be authentic, I mean, it's just inconceivable that they're authentic from time.
Yes, it is. It is. And she, Altman, says that that's not the case. She has a different theory, which is bizarre, but I'll present it to you because it's interesting in a sense. Dr. Altman notes that in the 1863 report of a committee set up by the Ethnological Society, that report agreed with Dr. Fischel's conclusions. Nonetheless, this report has been ignored by the archaeological world. She writes, quote, "Why was the identification ignored? Because neither the committee's report nor officials' identification fit the two models erected with regard to these artifacts. On the one side, we had a group who maintained that the artifacts were evidence of the presence of the 10 lost tribes of Israel in ancient America. On the other side, we had a school who declared the artifacts were modern forgeries. Dr. Altman then presents a new and novel explanation of what the five Newark Holy Stones really are, and it really is novel. There are five pieces, she writes, four of which compose a set of ritual artifacts of two types. The fifth item is a case made to order to house one of the ritual artifacts. The two types are intended for different purposes. Type one consists of a head, Rosh, which Dr. Altman identifies as the Johnson-Bradner stone, and hand, Yad, phylacteries. Now, let's look at what phylacteries look like. They're on the last page. They're not made of stone. Those are called tefillin in Hebrew, phylacteries. This is something that is worn in the morning during the week, during prayer, by men. 13 years and over. They are not made of stone. They have inside certain parts, certain verses of the Torah that are written and put inside, okay? And there are straps, etc. So they're not made of stone at all. They never made it. They wouldn't be proper. They wouldn't be considered kosher if they're very strict laws regarding what tefillin have to look like. In any case, she says, type one consists of head, Rosh, that's Rosh's head in Hebrew, which Dr. Altman identifies as the Johnson-Bradner stone, and hand, Yad, phylacteries, tefillin, made of black limestone. Black is required for phylacteries, she points out. That's true. The hand phylactery is 6 7/8 inches in length and 2 7/8 inches in width and 1 3/4 inches in thickness. The artifact, the Decalogue stone, is inscribed in the incantation format and displays a variant of a known condensed version of the Decalogue with abbreviations and composite graphs that dates to before the 2nd century BCE. The head phylactery inscribed with two of the four excerpts of Exodus required by halacha, by Jewish law, is also written in the spirals of an incantation format and is also made of black limestone. Not only a lithograph Now only a lithograph of the headpiece remains. The phylactery was approximately 3 inches long by 1 3/4 inches in thickness and tapered from approximately 1 inch on the at the top to a rounded point at the bottom. So her claim is that instead of the verses being put inside, they were written on the thing, which is okay, which is bizarre. Type 2, made of novaculite, a very hard, fine-grained rock, consists of a flow detector. That's the keystone. For determining whether water is stagnant or flowing, and thus pure. In terms of Judaism, there's a certain ritual concept of water that's flowing water, that water is quote-unquote pure. And a bowl for containing the water for ritual purification prior to donning the phylacteries. The flow detector is four-sided and approximately 6 inches in length by 1 5/8 inches in thickness and bears a resemblance to a rounded plumb bob. Dr. Altman analyzes each of the holy stones and the writings on them. In part, she writes, the two phylacteries are made of black material, which is in accord with the rabbinical law that phylacteries must be black in color. Of course, phylacteries can never be made of stone, but that she seems to ignore. That doesn't bother her. Although contrary to Palestinian and Babylonian rabbinic rulings in the 2nd century CE, the use of condensed decalogue is in accord with a known prior tradition. That other traditions continue to exist alongside the Palestinian and Babylonian tradition is known from the Dead Sea Scrolls papyri from Egypt. Based on her analysis, she comes to the following conclusions. The artifacts could not possibly have been created in the 19th century. Nobody had the knowledge necessary to do so. Indeed, nobody who previously examined these artifacts has recognized that two of the artifacts are inscribed in the ancient incantation format, nor has anyone previously realized that the peculiar font is a consolidated design or that it is a grid font typical of scripts and fonts used with incantation formats. It is rather clear that no one until today has recognized the late medieval Hebrew script that is the base script of this consolidated grid font. The Newark ritual artifacts are neither forgeries nor relics of ancient America. They are, however, very important concrete evidence of ancient and medieval Israelite practices. So she's convinced that they're genuine. There are obvious difficulties with Dr. Altman's theory, the most important of which is why the person who created the quote-unquote fill in the phylacteries would have made them out of stone, which, while certainly retaining purity, as he suggests, would not be viable as tefillin altogether. So really, we don't know what these things are. We really don't. We really don't know whether they're forgeries. We don't know quite what they are. They are strange things that I think are interesting in their own right, the fact that they were found. By the way, this is not the only thing in Hebrew that's been found here. In New Mexico, there's some sort of a huge stone with Hebrew writing on it, and that's pre-exilic. That's written in the script that was used before Ezra. Don't ask me. Don't ask me, because I certainly don't know.
Itinerant rabbis.
Could be.
One would think that this material can now be dated.
I guess so, but that's not in any of what I was able to find. There's some guy at who has a website who became interested in this. He put it up, a lot of it in the 90s. Doesn't mention anything about dating. I don't know how accurate dating is anyway.
But from how close can you come? 1860 is pretty, it must be accurate.
Yeah, I
don't know, but that's one point.
I hear you, yeah.
So what is it, at the end, it is not 19th century, and it is not the ancient. So what is the conclusion?
She says that they are, however, very important concrete evidence of ancient and medieval Israelite practices.
Without dating.
Right. They're neither forgeries nor relics of ancient America.
I have an idea here.
Yeah.
Particularly with regard to the keystone and possibly the sandstone boxes and decalogue stone. Even in the colonial period, there were thousands of settlers who went into areas that were not part of settled British colonies or later even the United States. And
right.
Ohio would fit
yep, yep.
geographic area.
Yep.
I'm wondering if Jewish merchants might not have been in the area, and in trading with the native tribes, the native tribes kind of liked these things, and they traded for them.
But what would a Jew do with this? This doesn't fit any known Jewish tradition.
You've been carrying these things.
Why would you?
Service in terms of a
yeah. Well, why would a Jew have it? Why would he make it? Why would anybody make it? That's the question. You see, they don't fit. They
but
don't.
In ancient times, would they have been used in a service?
This no, not that I know. No. Tefillin are very ancient phylacteries, like I showed you in the picture.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Phylacteries are mentioned in the Bible, but it does not tell you what they're supposed to look like. And the whole oral tradition around that tells you what it's supposed to look like, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And that goes way, way back, okay? But this sort of a thing?
Now, are phylacteries usually made of leather?
Yes, they are. They're made of leather. Sure, they're made of leather, yeah.
But her conclusion is that the inscriptions are ancient and medieval.
Right.
The inscriptions. But how about the physical objects? She's not making any claim about that.
No. She claims that they're tefillin.
Might have been 18th century, and with the inscriptions of medieval times.
Maybe, but again.
I'm just saying, within.
Yeah. Right. But her theory is really quite.
She's not talking about the physical.
Right, but she claims that they're tefillin, and that's a far-fetched claim.
You know, another aspect of this, I'm wondering, some Mormons did go to Ohio, and I wonder if they were just parroting what they thought was meaningful Hebrew.
I don't know. This I will tell you. The Pilgrims knew Hebrew. Some of them knew Hebrew very well. They studied Hebrew. In fact,
especially.
Yes, but in fact, in all of the colleges that were founded before the Revolution,
Mormon taught Hebrew when it was founded in the 17th century.
Right. And Ezra Stiles introduced Hebrew as mandatory at Yale, because he was very, very interested in Hebrew, and he's around the time of the Revolution. He's earlier, et cetera. And he was alive during the Revolution. Came to Harvard. Came to Yale after, during the Revolution, et cetera. And in fact, Yale's emblem has Hebrew on it because of him. But so yeah, they certainly were familiar with Hebrew, and there were. There's a gentleman named Jonathan Logan who lived in Pennsylvania in the 18th century. Who became a formidable Hebrew scholar, and spent a great deal of time studying it. So there was great interest. And in fact, it was felt that you couldn't be an educated Christian clergyman unless you could read the Bible in the original.
Right.
How could you know what it was saying? And indeed, that's very true, because if you look at some of the translations, they're so far from what it was. But again, the mystery remains. I have no idea what these things are. I don't think anybody really does.